this week's podcast, The Hours by Savvy Coaching. I'm Tyler, this is Mark, and we get to talk basketball. And you might be one of the first few that's actually listening to this audio only on our new RSS feed. We decided we just want to share this basketball conversation with the world because it's in line with our mission to revolutionize the way the game is taught and played. Mark, when, this is not the big question, this is a small question that I just thought of. When did you first shift your focus or have the thought of, I don't just want to coach my team, I want to impact how others coach their teams?
So when did that shift occur? Probably 2018. I had a lot of coaches start to reach out and just say, hey, love the way your team plays. Could you share some stuff with me? And started visiting with coaches all over and instantly just fell in love with helping other people do what I felt strongly about and believed in.
Okay, so scale of 1 to 10, three questions. Question one, scale of 1 to 10, 10 being the best. You can use 8 or 9. How much joy did you feel playing the game of basketball?
6.
How much joy did you feel when you first started coaching the game or when you coached the game of basketball?
More than that, 7, 8.
Somewhere. And how much joy do you get from coaching coaches to coach the game of basketball?
Oh, 10, man. I love
it. Yeah, that's good. You're in your pocket then.
I am.
You're absolutely in your pocket.
I feel really fulfilled doing this. And it's that's why, yeah, it's so fun, you know. Wake up thinking about it, go to sleep thinking about it.
Yeah. No, that's awesome. And I've observed that and I felt that, but I've never actually asked you that. So, that you're in your pocket. I love it. Okay, those are the small questions. Here's the big question. And I'll start with a confession. I probably had my most emotional and angry interaction with a referee in the past decade about 2 weeks ago. Did I share this with you already? Did I share this on the Hours? No. Okay. About 2 weeks ago, I've been traveling. I was home for just a weekend. I actually played in a pickleball cash game that morning and had a very disappointing loss. So I was in a heightened emotional state when I drove over to coach my daughter's, 11 and under basketball game. And I'm coaching this game and we start getting pressed. And, you know, we're teaching our players to play fast, right? And our approach is to let the rice cook. I'm not stopping them through all of their mistakes, like just, you know, coaching in line with our beliefs. And then this one young referee, I think we've all experienced this, who was just like shooting around during timeouts, like not running across half court, like just like too cool, like joking around with the parents and like feeling like talking to the players, like when they, you know, like telling them what to do, all of these things, like already was starting to kind of rub me the wrong way with like his nonchalance or lack of professionalism. But you can tell that he probably played maybe at a small college level, all that stuff. So he thought he knew a lot of stuff. So our players start getting pressed and they start turning the ball over and making mistakes and whatnot. And, you know, they're continuing to play fast and we're letting the rice cook. And so, I think the other team called a timeout. The ref came over to me and he's like, hey, you know, you probably want to tell your players that they need to start to play slower. He's like, I've been trying to work with your point guard, you know, a little bit. And I said, hey, I got mad. I said, please don't coach my team. I'm actually asking them to do the opposite thing as you. He's like, man, I think you should probably listen to me. And I got really, really upset. And so the rest of the game, like I started to like take that out on him, like run across half court, right? or like, hey, you might want to watch for this. And I stopped focusing on like allowing our process to happen. And like, I felt like I needed to coach him up. And so coming out of that, I realized that was absolutely the wrong approach. And that's where this question comes from. Thank you for letting me work through that. And I'm asking you, is it even worth it? Is it ever worth it to talk to referees?
Usually no, to be honest. And this comes from someone that has grown a lot in his relationship with referees. I was a very young head coach. So, you know, level one, right? You think you know it all. And I viewed them as, I guess not the enemy, but just as, I don't know, a vehicle or obstacle, you know, to just, I completely changed the way I looked at referees. I think a lot changed, honestly, when we won a state championship. It's like, hey, you know, we had a lot of bad calls. We had players foul out and all this stuff along the way, and we won a state title. So I think I just shifted my mindset in a lot of ways. And I think I had a really good relationship with referees towards the end of my coaching career. So I would, if anything, I would ask some questions. I think it's important to compliment them when they make a good call, whether it's for your team or for the other team, and understand that they're basically being judged in an unfair way, right? They could make 27 great calls and one bad one, and that's the one we're going to remember. So I would say usually no. They're human. I would not let we want to keep them as unemotional as possible. So the only thing I would say, I'll say two things. If it's effort, like you're talking about, not crossing half court. I coached my daughter's team this fall, and it was in like a YMCA league where they weren't even attempting to get calls right. It was very inconsistent. 1 week they would call every single travel. The next week they would call no travels. That gets extremely frustrating because it's frustrating for the players. So if it's effort, yes. The other thing I will say is if you're going to talk to them, maybe before the game. Just a friend of mine had this. He would use this against referees. He would say, hey, is it if we're setting a screen, is it legal for us to lean into the defender as they're, you know, getting over the screen? And they would say, well, no, that'd be a moving screen. He would say, well, great. That team does it a lot. Could you please look at that? And he almost made them into like, hey, if we see it now, we have to call it. So I thought that was a really nice approach.
Yeah, I think agreed. Well answered. Let me do a follow-up. Have you felt like you've ever been able to influence referees' calls at all within the game?
If so, very rarely. I can't think of a case where I did, so I'm going to say no. Yeah, probably not.
Yeah, and I would say rarely as well, but yes, at times, especially if you do all the things you suggested beforehand, befriend them, create relationship, compliment their calls, and then I think those questions during a dead ball, where you say, can you keep an eye out for this, has created some level of influence, but only if you do the other things first.
Yeah, I'm going to interject this and you can go again. Can you watch for this is a great way to approach it. The huge red flag for me is like the first time you say something to an official, it's like, hey, Tyler, hey, Mr. Ref, could you please watch their screens? I think they're leaning a little bit, or, you know, and if they bark back at you, you know you're in for it.
You're done.
And I would say it's probably an inexperienced referee or one that's not very secure. My initial response would be to go back at them and just like, hey, I'm just asking you to watch for it. I learned it's just like, oh, this is wrong guy, right? Wrong guy, wrong girl. Let's wait for them to rotate and maybe I can get to someone else.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think in conclusion, and this is for me, the more I talk to referees, regardless of if I impact the game and their calls or not, I just like who I am as a coach less when I'm engaging and putting my energy into that. I feel more frustration, and I perceive the game very differently than when I'm completely just focused on the long-term development of my team. I like who I am better when that's my focus and not my focus on the referee. And I think it's because it brings me into win this game at all costs mode when I talk about the referees, because talking to the referees doesn't actually impact the long-term development of your players. Whereas in the other side would be, let me teach our players throughout this experience how to respond to poor calls or inconsistent calls or whatever. as opposed to trying to change the environment. And I think that's really the balance that I feel more so than the impact.
Yeah, I completely agree. This is something that I observe almost every time I'm in the gym, and no matter the level, the coach gets upset, which influences the players.
Mm-hmm.
Parents see their son's daughter, the players, upset. So then the fans get upset, and then it's just a recipe for disaster. Yeah. And it's all dictated on the head coach's response. That's something for head coaches to be aware of, is if your players are really frustrated with the officiating, they're probably getting it from you because you're arguing every call, you're making comments. If you ignore it, they likely won't even notice it. And then I'll say this, if both coaches are arguing with the refs, they're probably doing their job, right? Because it means that, every time a call goes your way, you're like, oh, good call. Every time it doesn't go your way, you're arguing it. And that's just a bad place to be as a head coach as well.
Yeah. All right. Awesome. That I needed that. So I hope that some other coaches needed that. Let's be the change on that. And it would stand out so blatantly. If you as a head coach, if your program top to bottom just coached your team, I think it's special and Savvy does want to be special. We want to get it. We want to understand it. So let's shift into mailbag. We have so much great interaction in our community. And in fact, as we launch into this first one, we hope with taking this podcast public and going audio only, we truly hope that we get to impact even more coaches than the coaches that are already in our coaching community, taking our courses, consulting with us, part of our membership. We hope that we get so many more, especially as we share it on YouTube as well. And so that being said, I just wanted to get a brief visual for those of you that are going to be on YouTube. Like, this is our coaching community. The link is in the description below. If you're watching on YouTube, you can find our community at savvycoach.com. If you want to go just find it on the internet, it's free to join. These are all the conversations that are happening from Savvy coaches all across the world. We have a number of European coaches in there as well. And so we would love to have you join our community. That's where we get these questions. And we'd love to get you to ask more questions. So let's go ahead and start with this one for you, Mark. It's a two-parter. I'll just give you the first part. How would you structure a one-on-one discussion with a player about their role? There's so much going on in our community around role definition and role clarity. And here's the challenge, and I've run into this. Every coach agrees role definition, role clarity is a huge opportunity for them this year. It's how you can improve your team without changing your team. And yet there's also significant nervousness and reluctance to have those conversations with a player because they're uncomfortable and there can be disagreement. And it tends to trigger one of the biggest pain points for us as coaches is parents and parent complaints or parent concerns. So this is very, very relevant. The obstacle is the way. Everyone wants to level up, but shies away from this amongst many other obstacles. The obstacle is the way to level up. So let's help you get there. Mark, how do you structure those discussions? How do you go about it?
Yeah, really good question. I would say area of growth for almost every coach is the ability to have honest, hard conversations. And like you said, not run away from them. Where there's a lack in communication, negativity is going to fill it. So be proactive. And I think meeting, just create a system, right? So have a one-on-one meeting with your players once a month. That would be my standard. In that meeting, I'll share a different approach here. I would have that player write down 5 ways they help the team and 5 ways they hurt the team. Because I don't think players think about the hurt the team side of the equation. And as a coach, we are, right? Like, we know what they bring to the table and what their area of growth is right now. So I think that would just help with some self-awareness. I'm not the tallest guy in the world. I am 5'7", 5'8 on my driver's license, but probably really 5'7". And I know I'm not going to help the team rebound or interior defense. The effort might be there, but there's probably going to be somebody that's going to be better than me, right? And I think just being truthful with players in that conversation of, hey, when we play a bigger, more physical, stronger team, your minutes might go from 17 minutes to 12 minutes, and that's why, right? I'll also say this. I think players want the truth. They might not want to hear, well, you don't shoot it well, or you can't shoot the ball, but they want to hear how their skill set matches up against everybody else. And not comparing them to players, but what their role is going to be based on what they do well or what they don't do well. I think everybody wants to be told that. So as far as how I would structure that conversation, I think anytime you're meeting with a player one-on-one, communication should be at least 50-50. I think oftentimes as a coach in those one-on-one meetings, we talk 90% of the time. We feel much better about ourselves after the meeting, and the player usually leaves kind of in the same spot that they were in beforehand. So I always gave my players a Google form before any one-on-one meeting. I would ask any questions I wanted in relation to their role in advance, give them time to reflect. And it also gives me time to reflect on their answers and better frame the conversation.
Yeah. I think the only thing that I would highlight in summary is to normalize these discussions. If the only time that you're having these one-on-one discussions is when there's a problem or a conflict, a disagreement about their role, then there's going to be a lot of negativity around it. But when it's like, nope, we have these one-on-one discussions regularly, and they would include increasing your role and decreasing, or, you know, improving or refining. If you normalize it and it doesn't come as a surprise and it doesn't seem punitive, that's the first step in actually having these role conversations. And I think it's similar to the referee thing. The energy that we bring to these discussions as coaches rubs off on the players, and that's the energy they're going to bring to these discussions. If we have, hey, can't wait to have our one-on-one, can't wait to visit with you one-on-one, can't wait to help you one-on-one become everything you can be as a player and contribute to this team. If we're looking forward to these one-on-one discussions, they might also, but if we're like, hey, we got to have this conversation, and we're very, you know, tentative and anxious, as will they be. So I think those would be the two additional pieces that I would remind everyone of.
Yeah, man, that could have been the big question. That was
that could have been the big question, or maybe yeah. maybe it will in the future.
I'll add one thing, because our the person that asked the question in the community said, "What do you do if they don't accept or they disagree with the role?" I would have the expectation for my program is at some point you're going to have to choose what's best for yourself or the team. In our program, we expect you to choose what's best for the team. Simple as that. So especially this time of the year, off season, be really selfish in pursuit of your own individual skills. You should be. But when the season comes, still be selfish in pursuit of your skills, but very unselfish with how that blends in with the team. So it's the juggling act of individual player versus team. Unfortunately, this we always have to pick the team first, or almost always. Yeah. Can't think of a reason why we wouldn't pick the team, but I don't like to speak in absolutes either.
Well, the only reason that I have this team is for my kid to get a scholarship, Mark. So that would be
obviously.
Go play an individual sport if that is going to be your desire. I think that's just the difference between team sport. Okay, I'll take this one first. How would you train and teach players to finish off of 2 feet more? While the skill might not be that difficult, finishing off of two, the perception or the decision of slowing down and playing off of two instead of trying a difficult off-balance layup is the key. So how would you do this? One-on-one, three-on-three, and five-on-five. I will answer this in reverse order, five-on-five, three-on-three, then one-on-one. I'll give a very practical and direct applications that I think will move the needle in that direction. Then I think Mark will talk a little bit more about the principles. So here it is, five-on-five. When playing five-on-five, introduce a violation. And a violation I like to use is one called lack of control. It has a hand signal. My hands are moving back and forth like this, like I'm not controlling something. anytime a player plays off balance, off of one foot with the defender near them in the paint with them, when they need to play off of 2 feet, we just blow the whistle, lack of control, whether the shot is made or missed. It's upon the attempt, not upon whether it goes in, and it's an automatic turnover. You don't have to argue, you don't have to cajole, and you don't even have to teach. You just change the constraint. And what you'll find is immediately players play off of 2 feet more. I'll give all three, then I'll give one summary. In 3-on-3, just lock them. In 3-on-3, actually just say that we're not going to call any violations, but the only finish that will count as points is going to be one off of 2 feet. I'm not going to call a turnover. You can finish it. We'll play continuously, FIBA style. Just like if it's off 1 foot, it just doesn't count. So it doesn't stop. It's a little bit different, right? It just impacts the scoring. I would just lock the scoring that way. In one-on-one, one way that I've done this is say, okay, we're playing one-on-one with normal scoring, but any foul drawn is going to be worth double. It's going to be worth 2 points if we're playing by ones and twos. And it's much easier to use fakes, initiate contact, and draw fouls off of 2 feet. So those are like three just little constraints or adjustments or violations that one can introduce in those scenarios. You could switch those around, but those are my preferred methods. And then here's the summary and the key. We're searching for aha moments in doing so. An aha moment is a moment where a player is like, oh, that's what it feels like. That's a scenario when I should play off to. Oh, that worked. Oh, I value this beyond the coach telling me this is important. And the way to connect those aha moments is to ensure that you debrief. And when you debrief after playing 5-on-5 or 3-on-3 or 1-on-1, my favorite question is, what did you like or what did you learn from that competition? And that helps us uncover aha moments. And we can also have aha moments when other people find success. So if, you know, Mark is saying, hey, I really like how much more I saw passes, able to throw harder passes once I stopped off 2 feet instead of passing in the air. He shares that aha moment. I'm like, oh, Mark's a pretty good player. And I'm competing with him, and he realized that maybe I should try that more. Or I really respect Mark. Like, I really like him. He's very popular, right? And so, like, you know, just like these are things that influence players. So I think those debrief moments are as important as the moments that they might have in a game.
Yeah, really good. I would share something on the why too, where you're saying, you know, the aha moment. Instead of just saying and pleading, hey, we have to play off 2 feet. We have to play off 2 feet. Tell them why, right? Like, why is this going to make us better? We're going to be able to finish through contact. We can finish in traffic better. And then we have, like you said, more balance to throw better passes. And it just gives you a plan B. When do we stop or play off 2 feet and pivot is when we're unsure. So if I don't have a 9 off 1 foot, just big advantage, wide open layup. If I don't engage two defenders in pitch, if I don't have a clear answer, playing off 2 feet is going to give you that plan B. So why do we do it? Anytime we're playing in traffic, you're going to have more balance, more power. It's going to allow you to finish more. One way you talked about, I love the violation of the out of control and you're only scoring shots off 2 feet. What if you went the other way? And I haven't done this, but as you were talking, it gave me the idea. What if we create a small-sided game or even just played one-on-one and said all finishes have to be off 1 foot and put them in a situation where they fail instead of setting them up to succeed and then say, all right, now all finishes have to be off 2 feet and then let the results speak for themselves in that situation. So that might be a creative way to illustrate to players. So why do we play off 2 feet? More balance, more power, more time. When do we play off 2 feet? When bodies are in front or bodies on a side. So short answer, when we're playing in traffic. If there's any type of defenders in the paint, then we're likely going to play off 2 feet. There are times where I see players drive into a mass of humanity. Like there's like 800 pounds of help defense in there and they are just flying in there off 1 foot. Usually that is the pain point, right? That's what we want to eliminate. I think playing off 2 feet would instantly help your shot selection and your effective field goal percentage, which is what we're all trying to do. So how would I get my team to do that quickly? I think the prerequisite, or I think the step that sometimes we skip, is having them be able to play through foot fakes and pivots at the rim. Just developing some patience. What I have found, especially at lower levels, is players think the second I get into the paint, I've got to make a quick decision. I've got to stop and shoot or stop and pass right away. So first step in getting my players to play off 2 feet, remove the dribble, have them play one-on-one, no dribble right around the rim, and just get them accustomed to playing around the rim with shot fakes, foot fakes, and pivots.
That's good. Okay. We're going to transition from the offensive side to the defensive side right now. And the question came in from a new Lock Left coach. What are words that you say in communication to trigger the right defensive footwork and to get them talking to each other? And what reminders might a coach give possession by possession? What's a starting point? So here are the 5 most common scenarios that players and coaches in the Lock Left need to refine and improve. Each one of these verbal cues that can be given as reminders from the coach, reminders from players, reminders from the bench, have a corresponding physical outcome. And these are the 5 physical outcomes that I coach in order, both when installing and improving the Lock Left. So I'll give you all 5 words right now, and then we'll go through what they mean and what physical correspondence and physical thing that we're training would be. Sit, wall, gap, snipe, and fly. Sit, wall, gap, snipe, and fly. So first and foremost, our bench, players on the floor will say sit, sit, sit. And sit should trigger a reminder for our on-ball defender to sit in a stance, nose to right hand. Sit in a stance and on the right hand. Do not allow a right hand dribble. Do not allow a right hand attack. Most players, especially coming from like a defensive zigzag training experience or trying to keep a player from a rim experience, they're constantly jumping out of their stance and moving from side to side. And so instead of getting up out of a stance, getting up to like try to steal the ball, chasing the ball, we just want to sit on the right hand. And that really, really, I think, has improved our team especially. They've really bought into that, and they'll just be screaming it from the bench, which is pretty fun. Okay, we'll stay really high level on this stuff. Wall. Wall is what in common vernacular would be the low man. It's going to be your lowest help defender, usually in the smile. It's the most important help position. And as we want to take away all 3s in the Lock Left, and we want to take away all 9s in the Lock Left open layups, that low man is going to be the one that's primarily responsible for building a wall between the ball and the rim. So wall, wall, wall triggers our low man to move over heavier into help and into the smile. That's what wall is. And that's probably the second most important thing that we're reminding as a coaching staff, and a player would then say, I got wall, 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 instead of saying help. So it's a little bit different. The third step would be gap. And gap is going to be traditional gap, but only gap towards jail. It's going to be one pass away to the left of the offensive player or towards jail. And their job in gap is to give a visual discouragement and visual help, but not physical help. In the gap, we don't want them actually stopping drives. We want them visually discouraging drives. And when the ball's dribbled, we want them to skirmish and then go hunt the pass so that we don't give up off the catch 3s. Snipe. Snipe is what we'd be doing one pass away to the right of the ball or away from jail. And snipe, the goal is to snipe or steal any pass right. It's different than deny. Deny is we want to discourage a pass. Snipe is we want to steal a pass. So we're giving some glimmer of hope. We're chest to ball. We're a little bit below the line on snipe. But more importantly than keeping that pass from being made is we want to set ourselves up for opportunities to steal it with no repercussions if you gamble and get beat. We encourage that. We want to steal that pass with the outside hand with our thumb up instead of with a traditional deny inside hand with the thumb down. Last, fly. Fly is the verbal cue that we would give to players or players would give to each other on any click pass, two out pass, dominoes catch. we want the on-ball defender to fly at the catch to give them only one option. We want to make every catch a dribble. So we fly at the right side of the body to make that a dribble left. We do not allow an off the catch three. We don't allow them to hold the basketball. Fly, fly, fly. It would be like our scramble sort of scenarios. We want to fly at every catch. It doesn't matter if it's your player or not. If you're the nearest player to the catch, you're flying at it. And that's how we combat dominoes when the offense has the advantage. That's kind of the check down order that I would use. I would introduce all these things at once, like get good at sitting, get good at getting on the wall, get good at the gap, then get good at the snipe. Because once you're good at the wall and the gap, there's going to be a lot more passes made to the right. So get good at sniping. And then once we can get good at those things, let's get a little bit better when we're in defensive disadvantaged dominoes.
Yeah, really good. I love the order in which you went, starting with sit, one ball. I think you should always design your defense from the goal out, right? Like, where are we trying to, like, we're trying to get the ball to jail, right? How are we going to protect the rim? But when you install your defense, I think it should be from the ball to the rim. Because if you can't guard the ball, you can't guard the rim, you can't guard the three-point line, and it's going to be really difficult to rebound because you're going to be in rotation. Mm-hmm. So one drill that I would do, I don't know if you've done something similar. I've just kind of named this drill as you were talking, one-on-one sit. So now when we say sit in games, players are connecting the terminology to the drill, where that means we're in a stance, we're on the right hand, and we're working on maintaining that position as the ball handler, you know, dribbles around, works us, and you could go sit to live. So we talk about three types of drills: teach, train, compete. This might be a training drill. Where you could say a win for the offense is to take, I don't know, three consecutive dribbles with their right hand. So they're not really trying to score. And I think by removing the basket, you get more focused effort on actually sitting in a stance with the right hand. So that would be something you could do daily, 30 seconds. Everybody gets a couple reps and then play one-on-one live right after. Or you could say, hey, give me 5 seconds of training and to compete. But I think most coaches should spend more time on guarding the ball in general in practice, whether it's a training drill or a competition drill.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a wonderful transition to the game of the week. You just got it. One-on-one sit is the game of the week. And I'm trying to think of a practice where you wouldn't want to include that at some level and improve on the ball. Because if you, like Mark said, if you can't guard the ball, everything else falls apart. You're going to find yourself spending a lot more time on rotations, which we just don't want to spend much time on rotations. So I think that's excellent. Any other, on that game of the week or in that 1v1 sit, any other progressions or variations that you think would be good to move into?
If I could, let me parlay this into the Teach Better segment. How about that?
Yeah, perfect.
Okay. When we are teaching guarding the ball, we're teaching with the buzzword of one-on-one sit. I will also say it's one thing for the coach to give that reminder, right? We don't want to really coach during the game as far as giving instruction. I do think buzzwords can serve as reminders. And I would do that a lot in practice, right? Like we might be playing a 3-on-3 small sided game, balls in the air. You're going from gap or snipe to on the ball. We might just say sit, and we want to make sure we're connecting that to the stance and the position, like we talked about. I think in our practice better, teach better, a good practice would be teach your players to communicate to their teammates just as a coach would. So Tyler's getting on the ball. I'll say, Tyler, sit, to give him that reminder. I would say highest level of communication defensively is me talking to my teammates, and it's not communicating what I'm doing. So if I'm the wall defender, I think it's layer one or base level to say, I got the wall, right? Well, if you're there, you probably know that you have the wall. As a help defender, as the wall defender, I should be talking to Tyler, telling you to sit, because if that ball goes to the left, we've got your help, right? So we want to make sure that you're putting it in jail and not allowing the right hand to drive, which we're not as prepared for, right? We're not anticipating the right hand to drive. So my teach better suggestion this year would be do some defensive drills. If you want to start with shell, you could. We would encourage you to move away from shell, but in your small-sided games, any defensive drill, I would add the constraint that your defenders have to be talking to a teammate, not communicating what they're currently doing at that time.
Yes. Okay. Let me summarize this with maybe some language that's sticky to you, it's sticky to me. So you talk about levels of communication and moving players through levels of communication. Here's the three levels. Here's what I would name the levels that you just suggested. Okay. Me, you, we. Are you a me communicator, or a you communicator, or a we communicator? Me, you say what you're doing. You tell one other person what they should be doing. We, you tell us all what we should be doing. And measurement is magic. And so sharing with players, hey, right now, you're a level zero communicator. You don't even say what you're doing, right? Or you're a level one or a level two communicator. Let's work on moving you up to a level, whatever their next level is. When you measure, when you name things, it actually allows people to progress. When you just say that you don't talk, we're not talking, right? Nothing changes when you say talk, blah, 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 right? That's not communication. So that would be the three levels, me, you, we. And then, yeah, let's throw in the level zero if necessary. But I think if you share that and rate players, and even like one simple thing that you can do in this 1v1 game to make it even better is, let's say you play 1v1, put them in groups of three to play this 1v1 game. And the third person that's off is just going to give feedback to the defender on their communication, right? Or the person that's off is just going to watch this group of three when you go into even like a 3-on-3 game and just give feedback on someone's communication. A lot of times we don't improve communication because we have everyone doing something and no one ever actually like watching and giving feedback. It practices two people communicating. So if I'm giving Mark feedback on his communication, Mark's going to get improve his communication because I'm giving him feedback, but I'm also going to improve my communication because I'm watching for communication. But I can't watch for communication if I'm passing and catching the basketball. So just another reason to have like groups that are a little bit larger, but with an objective and an intent for what that person that is watching, what are they watching for? And you can do that for anything. You can do that for 2 feet finishes, any of the other things that we talked about.
Yeah, that's really good. It's a great way to keep players that are quote unquote off to still be engaged and take value in the rep. Getting mental reps too, right? So they have a mental image of what it should look like, which I think is a great way to lock it in. So I love the me, you, we. Reminds me of Brains, Books, and Buddies, but that's for another conversation. Tyler, you want to tell us a little bit about next month's cohort?
Yep. So we have our good friend Shane Kuiper, who's going to be bringing his expertise. He's a ex-Division I player and a European professional coach. He's going to be bringing in one of the college coaches that he has been mentoring to take us through the good work that he has been doing with coaches at all levels that he calls being a healthy competitor, and going to help both us as coaches and so we can help our players really develop an identity that is rock solid and unshakable and doesn't change based on only our performance. I'm excited about it. He'll be joining us next week for our edition of the hours to kick off and provide an overview of what that is. So stay tuned for a special edition of the hours next week. We'll be premiering it on Wednesday of next week. And then coming out of that, he's going to be doing just with our Grow members or anyone that chooses to join us for a 1 month cohort. He's going to be doing a live cohort training with himself, one of his college coaching friends, and all of our Grow members. He'll be doing that once a week throughout the month of July. You can sign up and check it out. We'll provide a link here at the bottom of the description if you're interested in signing up for the July cohort with Shane Kuiper. And again, as always, our Grow membership, it is included, and we'd love to continue to work with you on that.
Yeah, we had a chance to hear Shane present around the Final Four, and he had a very small, concise presentation.
Beautiful. Well, until next time, stay savvy. I'm Tyler.
Stay savvy.
I was going to let you say I'm Mark, but you know, that's Mark. Yeah, I didn't know if it worked. I threw it out of bounds. You were cutting, wow. And that was my fault.
Hey, yeah, we'll get next time. I missed it.
Yeah, later.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.